All right, everyone. Congratulations for surviving your first day at Sunstone. We are excited to open up our Friday sessions. Today, we invite you to celebrate what it means to Mormon as a verb, not a noun. Sunstone invites you to show us how you Mormon. If you haven't yet, make sure you grab a Sharpie from the front desk and write your name badge on your name badge what kind of Mormon you are or want to be. We are striving to build a community where your authentic Mormon experience is recognized as a legitimate Mormon experience, and you are part of it. Thank you for attending session 217, titled Epistemological Guardianship, The Importance of How We Know What We Know. Before we begin, we ask that all cell phones are turned off and that those attending will be respectful and attentive. It is the mission of Sunstone to host thoughtful and respectful dialogue. Please keep that in mind when engaging in the Q&A portion of this session following the remarks of the presenters. Those who cannot abide by those guidelines should refrain from commenting and will be asked to leave should they become disruptive. This session is being recorded, and you will be able to purchase it after the presentation ends at the registration desk on the main floor. Take advantage of our symposium special by subscribing to Sunstone Magazine, 7 issues for the price of 6, at the registration desk as well. Consider also purchasing Skullcandy official headphones customized just for Sunstone. They're actually pretty cool. Your support goes directly to keeping symposiums and 40 years of thoughtful dialogue alive and sustainable. Don't forget to check out the bookstore in the ballroom hosted by Benchmark Books. Consider purchasing a book or two to support Mormon studies and scholars. This session is 60 minutes long, and we ask both audience and presenters to keep within the framework of that time so we can allow for the next session to start on time. As a courtesy to other presenters and our attendees, we ask that immediately after the session you clear the room and speak outside so other presentations can begin preparation for the next session. About this session, I know the church is true is a very loaded statement. With over 13 years of professional experience working with data, Mithrin is very familiar with executives who claim to know things that turn out to not be true. This presentation has been given professionally to discuss the concept of how we know what we know in a business setting and to help individuals consider what counts as knowledge and how to guard that precious kernel that drives business and or individual action, what we know to be true. Mithrin, a.k.a. Kenneth Lines, has been active in posting about Mormonism on Reddit since 2009. He has published 2 books, The ABCs of Science and Mormonism and I Should Start a Cult. Now I'll turn the time over to Kenneth Lines.
Can't be professional on everything, right? Okay. Can we dim it a little bit? Is there a way to dim lights? Because that's not as visible. I can see that everyone here has discovered the secret of coffee because you're here at a 9 a.m. session. Thank you very much. I was originally slated for 4:30. No dimming. Lighting control system. I'll let someone else figure it out while we start talking. Yeah, that's exactly what I did. Okay. Well, hopefully you can see. If not, it won't be quite as funny. There is a local children's song that I think all of you probably are aware of, at least somewhat, that illustrates epistemological guardianship really well. Come on. The microphone's over here and the mouse is over there. Let's do this. There we go. All right. For those of you that are aware or not aware, there's this song about a tree that is very peculiar. It pops popcorn as opposed to apricot blossoms. And the song goes something like this. I looked out the window and what did I see? Popcorn popping on the apricot tree. It wasn't really so, but it seemed to me. And that is the entire concept of epistemological guardianship summed up in this children's song that when the child, we presume it's a child when we're singing, I suppose, like us, got out of bed in the morning and looked at the tree, it appeared to be popcorn on it, and the child claims knowledge of this. I know that it's popcorn. Come on. But how can one truly know if it is popcorn? How do we get to that frame of knowledge? The song even says, it wasn't really so, but it seemed to me this knowledge was not true knowledge. And this is what companies run into time and time again. We're going to take it a little more on the religious context because we're here at Sunstone and we're allowed to do that. But normally I would just do this all with examples from the company itself. So our goal here is to kind of be the guardians, if you will, of this tree of knowledge, like a cherubim with a flaming sword guarding this popcorn tree and making sure that we have our knowledge is true knowledge and it isn't just that it seems to be true. And we'll see if we can get the video to work. Do we know if we have an internet connection? Anyone? I don't think I am. If not, I've got it on the thumb drive, so I may just desperately try that, but we'll see whether it can play it. Here we go. Will it play? Will it play? It will. Do we have any audio? So this is a demonstration that I show to companies quite frequently. And everyone makes the same mistake. I also, on my blog, exploringmormonism.com, I have a set of critical thinking lessons for children. And we start with this one. And I want you to know that the four-year-old and the executive get the same things wrong. So this guy comes out, and we apparently have no sound, so you're going to have to put up with me dictating what's going on. He says, I have a rule, and I want you to guess what my rule is. And all you can do is give three numbers in a sequence. I'll tell you whether it matches my rule or not. And there we go.
2, 4, 8.
You don't need to continue the sequence. You can propose a totally different sequence. Whatever you want to propose. And I will simply say yes or no. That follows my rule.
Oh, I hear it. I hear it. Let's see if we can get some audio volume. Okay. It is what it is. Just turn the sound up.
Screwed up, so now you have
no projector. But I heard the sound.
Yeah, the sound was
8. 1632.
All right, we're gonna start it over. Everyone, be really quiet.
And I have a rule in mind that these three numbers obey. And I want you to try to figure out what that rule is. But the way that you can get information is by proposing your own set of three numbers to which I will say yes, that follows my rule, or no, it doesn't follow my rule, and then you can propose what you think the rule is. Is that fair?
Yep.
Go. And I hit the button again.
No, it doesn't follow my rule, and then you can propose what you think the rule is. Is that fair?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so here are the three numbers.
Okay, I want everyone to play along at home. Ooh, we're loud now. Everyone play along. Three numbers. You can try to guess the rule. If you've got a pen and paper, I highly recommend writing down. Try to get the rule before he does. I have had one person in the history of doing this who got it on the third try. Everyone else followed the exact same pattern. Okay, can you crank the sound again?
2, 4, 8.
You don't need to continue the sequence. You can propose a
2, 4, 8.
You don't need to continue the sequence. You can propose a
The numbers are 2, 4, 8.
Whatever you want to propose, and I will simply say yes or no. That
two,
follows
four,
my
rule. 2, 4, 8. 1632.
1632. And
64.
Yeah. Those also follow my rule.
Okay.
What's the rule? What are you thinking?
Multiply by 2.
That is not my rule.
Did anyone think it was multiply by 2? Now we got one? Okay. Someone will admit it. Here we go.
That's not my rule. But you're allowed, if you want, propose three other numbers.
3, 6, 12.
3, 6, 12.
3, 6, 12. Follows my rule.
10, 20, 40.
10, 20, 40.
That follows the rule.
Yeah, I'm still multiplying by 2.
I know. I know what you're doing. And yes, it follows my rule, but no, it's not my rule.
5, 10.
10 and 20.
Follows my rule.
100.
200. 400.
I want you to know that I've had multiple executives do 100, 200, 400 right before I show this, and they all gasp.
Follows my rule.
500, 1,000, 2,000.
Follows my rule.
Want me to keep going?
But do I just keep going? You're going to tell me your rule?
Am I doing it the wrong way? Am I approaching this the wrong way?
You're totally fine, but you're approaching it the way most people approach it. Like, think strategically about this. You want information.
Yeah.
I have information. The point of the three numbers, right, is to allow you to figure out what the rule is.
Yeah. Okay.
I'm going to give you the numbers that I don't think fits the sequence.
I'm going to give you the numbers I don't think fits the sequence. And this is where Sorry, I walked away from the mic. This is where everybody starts to get it. And if you've ever done a science fair with kids, grandkids, or way back when, do you remember that the secret to the science fair was that you're trying to reject the null hypothesis? And that made no sense when you were a kid yourself. This is why we try to reject the null hypothesis. If we can swap back over to the projector, however that works. Technology magic. This idea that we try to reject or we try things we don't think fit it to find the rule is the key. That's what shifted when what's his name? It's in the front of my book. Started testing on frogs and running electrodes down them and seeing their legs quiver at the same time. Thank you. As Joseph Smith was deciding that he was going to dig up a golden book in his backyard, the two are contemporaries. One of them was trying to find the rule through guessing what didn't fit, and that changed science forever. Do I do a command P?
Yeah.
Maybe. Duplicate. This is what I get for going back and forth.
Fancy.
I know. And the reason that we run into this, whether or not we have a PowerPoint, the reason we run into this is that we have fallacies. We are built to fall into this. That's why everyone starts guessing 2, 4, 8, 16, 32, 64, why everyone goes 100, 200, 300. We have cognitive biases that make us want to back up what we already believe. Confirmation bias is very real, and I see it day to day. And just knowing that there is a thing called cognitive bias, it doesn't prevent us from falling into it. It's not as simple as like, oh, yeah, no, there's this fallacy, and if you just say the word fallacy, it doesn't mean that it's not, like, actually the thing. You can still do it day in and day out. And even when you point it out, hey, I think you've got a cognitive bias here, some people, they keep having the cognitive bias. You can't just fix it in them. Imagine that. So one of the things that's really important, and we're not going to get it, is this concept of being wrong. And if we had the whole system up and running, there's this TED Talk. I highly recommend you go and look it up on being wrong. And this by Kathy Schultz. And she talks about that she went on this road trip with her friend for 2,000 miles. And as she's going down the freeway, she finally leans over to her friend and says, "What's the Chinese symbol on all the rest stops?" And her friend is like, "What are you talking about?" They come up to the next one. The friend just bursts into laughter. And, of course, it's the picnic table sign. And she talks about what it feels like to be wrong. And the audience says things like, you know, what you might call out, it's shameful, it's embarrassing. She says, no. You're describing what it's like to find out you were wrong. Being wrong feels just like being right. You have no idea. You just keep marching off like the coyote over that cliff. And when you finally look down, that's when you plummet to the ground. This happens in business constantly. This happens in faith constantly. We march right off a cliff believing that we have this firm foundation. And in reality, our beliefs are not based on truth. This is why you need epistemological guardianship. Next. Epistemology is the theory of knowledge, especially with regard to its methods, validity, and scope. Epistemology is the investigation of what distinguishes justified belief from opinion. In Swedish, which is where I serve my mission, there are three words or three phrases. One is jag tror att. That means I have faith in. Another one is jag tycker om. I have a conviction of. We'll skip the third because just between those two, it makes a huge difference. There's a famous talk by a general authority where he says faith is different than belief. And the mission president's wife got up to give this talk. And she started to speak, and the translator had to say, "You have to sit down. It's the same word here. I can only say you have a strong conviction or you believe it. There's no, like, faith is knowledge is this concept we have in the LDS Church." Marvelous. Audio, video people, everyone. Marvelous. Maybe. Da, da, Hey, there we go. So when I am sitting in meetings, I actually keep a pad and paper next to me or my phone. We cannot. They told me that I am not allowed to dim lights, so this is as good as it gets. It's going to be as good as it gets at 10:30 as well, though, so at least the ex-Mormon moderator panel that I'm also part of will suck just as bad. So I'll sit in meetings, and when someone says, well, we know that, I will just take a note, and I'll wait until there's a break or a lull in the conversation, and I will just simply say, how? And they'll say, what? You know, way back when you said, we should have more white space on websites. How do you know that? I think I've got it on the next slide. Maybe, maybe not. Yeah, so in religion, this comes out very strongly, especially in the Mormon Church. We believe, or we know things from God, right? God gives us the conviction. You get a testimony by bearing it. God answers it through prayer. God is the ultimate source of knowledge, and all other sources of knowledge are lesser. Other ones that you commonly hear, it's tradition. The scriptures state we should, right? How do you know that God is good? I had a conversation with a good half dozen individuals on Reddit this last week that I didn't mean to get into, but yet there I was, about how you know that God is good. And they would always say, well, the Bible tells us so. And I said things like, well, but in the Bible, God commands Abraham to kill his son. And then he says, go ahead and cut off the tip of various body parts. How do you know that's good? Well, the Bible says it. Well, how do you know the Bible is correct? Well, God gave us that word. And around you go in a little circle. It worked the last time we tried it. That's a pretty common one. We see that in things like why are women not ordained to the priesthood with the ordained women out here? Well, we just haven't done it recently. Why should we do it again? It works right now. Why fix it? The Pope Prophet said to do it that way. And we hear that one an awful lot. Science backs up our claims about the word of wisdom, pork, wine, coffee, whatever it is, right? There's this appeal to science that comes up fairly frequently in our knowledge, which they never actually cite the sources of. When it comes to professional, when you're in the workplace, we've always done it this way. I hear that one a lot. I read we should do that in an article. That's the white space one. Everyone has read it in that article. There's about six articles out there that get cited. Maybe it's true. Maybe it isn't. It worked the last time we tried it. Sometimes you have to lead with your gut. That's my favorite excuse for ignoring all the data in the world that executives give me. The CEO said to do it this way, right? It's the same appeal to authority that is the prophet or pope. CEO said do it. The analysis shows we should do it this way. So this guardianship concept, right? This is about figuring out what actually counts as knowledge and codifying that. You can't just give these excuses anymore because someone in the company sat down and said, this is how we know things. So I sit on the CRO team, or at least I did up until a little bit ago. It was very inconvenient for this talk that I have to say I was on the CRO team. I'm still very closely paired with them. That is conversion rate optimization, or A-B testing. I worked for Adobe for 2 years and helped build the backbone of their worldwide system in A-B testing. If you don't know what A-B testing is, the quick, dirty version you will read everywhere is if you have a web page and you have one button that is blue and you make it orange, people will click it 10% more. And you measure that and then say, we should make all our buttons orange. It is way more complicated than that, but that'll work for the purpose of what's in your mind. If you want to think of it as a science fair with the little trifold things, we actually did that too at Adobe. They had a science fair. Where you have what you believe is happening and the change when you make one change to things. We did this with my children in chocolate chip cookies. We tried four different types of butter. We invited everyone in the neighbor over. We did in the neighborhood. We gave them a double blind. They would write out which cookie they thought was best. And the secret is the most expensive one won. The least expensive one lost. And the ones in the middle that were about the same price did about the same. So butter does matter when it comes to cookies. And I can say I know that because we tested it. Now, we didn't test all the types of butter, but there was a very strong correlation between price and quality of cookie. Make sense? So when we talk about this sort of thing, running that sort of A-B test, so let's say that white space is supposed to be better for your website. We can actually change the website for a portion of population. We split it into two groups, and we change and make there be more white space. And sometimes it matters. There was one test that we did. White space is probably the wrong thing to use because it's really hard to measure whether people care about how little there is on your website. But there was one we ran at Adobe, and it was a really simple idea. There were two pages. One of them said, if you want to get started, you should do this to get started. You should do this to get started. If you get started today, it will da-da-da. And then the button said, start your free trial. We changed that button to say, get started, so that the whole conversation matched what we were asking them to do. $350,000 a year, two words. Now, it's not that words are magic. It's that we figured out that having a consistent message mattered. That was the piece of knowledge we could add to the knowledge bank. We're going to talk about the knowledge bank in a bit. Data-driven decisions and analysis. Another way we can do it to add to your epistemological guardianship, you need to have good points of data and lots of points of data before you make decisions. If you really believe that women cannot hold the priesthood, and this is in chapter P in the book, what we should do is we should get a random sample of women and a random sample of men. We should give them voice changers and hang a blanket. We give them all the priesthood. We bring in sick people and we see if the men can actually heal greater than the women. No need to ask what the prophets have said. No appeals to authority. And if you want to be really good, right, because someone might say God still works in mysterious ways or whatever, we get apostates for your third group. Because they can't be influenced by the Holy Ghost anymore, right? That's what it says. And then you know you have a liftover control. If they bless all exactly the same, you got a priesthood problem. Let's see. Okay, trial and error, right? You can just keep trying it over and over again, and that whole excuse, it worked last time. You keep trying to see whether or not it works. And you'd make sure that it works again and again. And we do this a lot with our tests. We don't just run one test on one website. The company I work for now, we have about 50 websites that we manage. And we will test once, and then we will test on a different one. If it holds true for both, then we will roll out everywhere. And then we check the data because we're still not sure. We want to make sure that we have actually learned this. And there's been times where we've rolled it out everywhere and one website just tanks. I say websites, but this works for anything, right? Chocolate chip cookies included. So then the next thing that we can do is build a data dictionary or document what we've learned. I have a big spreadsheet at work, big kind of poster board piece of paper that I hang up that says what we know. And it's all the things that we have learned through this methodology. And then when people come over and they're like, hey, should we do this on our website? I can just like point, pick, is it on the list? Then we need to run a test on it. If it's on the list, this is what we've learned. We already know that. Go do your thing. And it saves time and effort, and we don't have to get into these debates. When people cite articles, how many articles? What are the sources, right? Let's document that. Let's make sure that we know. At our company, six different articles state it, we'll go ahead and run with it. We may still check the data. Because it may still be wrong for our particular clients or whatever. But let's document at the point where you get six, we'll run and try it. Or maybe it's two for your company. But you should know. It's not just someone throws out, I read in an article, so therefore we should change everything we do as our business practice. That's happened to me. So here's a hard example from one of the companies I worked for, not my current one. I had a VP who knew, and I hate the word no at this point when it's used like this, that there was cannibalization between paid search and unpaid. Now, for those of you who may not be in the web's worlds of everything, you know when you go to Google and there's this little paid ad at the top? That's paid. When you see something right below that doesn't have the little ad next to it, that's natural search. So people go into Google, they type in, I want to buy a blanket or whatever it is. You get the little advertisement. And his belief was that we were spending too much on the ads, that if we didn't spend so much, people would just naturally find the blankets that they were looking for or whatever it was by going to Google. And he estimated the value based on just traffic would be about $5 million to the company every year. This was a great initiative. This was going to change the company. And he decided that he was going to present at a conference on this before he talked to anyone who actually ran numbers. And then he filed a patent on it. And he was right. There was cannibalization, but, turns out it was about $500. I mean, it was happening, and you could see it happen, but it wasn't a big problem. And it took 6 months and $500,000 worth of effort to build out to find out that it was worth $500. This is the sort of thing that you can avoid if you ask, how do you know that? And you say, how can we test it? And my heroes here, Jamie Heineman and Adam, the Mythbusters, and we're going to jump right straight to the bottom one. do it on a small model, right? We could take one keyword and one website and one this and one that and get this little one and see what those rates are and then estimate the big one. We did that, by the way, and it estimated out to be $500 for the whole company. But he had already committed himself, both with the patent and with the speaking engagement. And this is where we find that epistemology goes awry. If we are committed to something, we want it to be right, and we look for that confirming bias. Remember the number thing? We want to keep saying 16, 32, 64, 200, 400, 800. I know it's multiplied by 2. I know it. But we don't really know it, and we walk right off the cliff like Wile E. Coyote. Why was it able to be built, this really expensive project that didn't produce it? Well, he had a VP title, right? You're going to do it because I say so. I know better than all y'all. There's my Texas coming out. Invested in the results because of knowledge that wasn't true knowledge. That's what we just talked about. We should have signed and measured the bias. So this is really key. I went to BYU to get my economics degree. I was in computer science for 3.5 years and then went over to econ. And I had one of my favorite classes ever, the history of economics, in which they talked about what to do with bad data. And I think we don't have enough classes that teach people what to do with bad data because data's always bad. You never have where it just draws the R-squared line or the trend line is like perfect and you're like, yeah, no, that's clear. It never happens. And we studied a fascinating subject, which is when slaves became profitable. It's kind of a touchy subject, so I'm not going to go too much into it. But it turns out about 28 years old, you were investing in the slave up to that point and then you started to reap benefits afterwards. And how they were able to get to that calculation, they had to take monumental amounts of journals and diaries and pieces of information and sales of slaves throughout the South and indentured servants in the North for comparisons. And then they had to sign and measure things that they couldn't know because there just wasn't enough data. You couldn't run the regression and with confidence. So this idea that you sign it, you say, okay, and we'll give the example that everyone, I hope, is familiar with here today. We know that Helen Mar Kimball was 14 years old, right? And the apologist will say something along the lines of, she was shy of 15, few months shy of her 15th birthday. But what they'll also say is something like, well, we don't really know. There's not enough information. If you go to the LDS.org essay today, it says we don't really have enough information about what Emma's feeling on the subject was. Well, what we can do, this is bad data, and they're right. There isn't enough data to 100% add it to our epistemological, like, we know it. But we can sign and measure it, right? The sources, are they for Joseph or against Joseph when it comes to Helen Mar Kimball? Well, we have Heber C. Kimball. Helen Mar Kimball herself wrote in her diary, and she stayed faithful to the church, right? The sign is always biased for Joseph. Right? Benjamin F. Johnson, every time he talks, whether he's telling the truth or not, it is pro-Brigham or pro-Joseph. You can't say that he's an anti-Mormon. Every time that, to contrast, Sarah Pratt, right? Sarah Pratt gives testimony, and I don't know how much you know. I'm sorry, I'm Mithrining here. We're getting into things that most people probably don't understand. But Sarah Pratt was against Joseph. Well, she was against polygamy, and she led an anti-polygamy group in Utah. And so maybe we sign that one as a negative, right? So we put all the data, and we sign it. And then we measure, right? Are they way biased, or are they kind of biased? Helen Mar Kimball, she way biased? Not really. It's hard to say that she was like making up stories that were outlandish of angels with swords forcing her. She doesn't have any of that, right? She gives this really straightforward, I was sad as a girl I didn't get to go to the dances. If you look at the LDS article I'm picking on the LDS today a little bit more than I normally do. They have more historians, and so you have more data. That's just the way it is. So if you look at the article on Joseph testing Heber C. Kimball with the principle of polygamy and that he asks for Violet, his wife – I just pronounced her name wrong. I'm sorry. Violet? Vilate? Vilate. Ah. I've only ever read it. I've never actually had to pronounce it before. Like chasm. That one screwed me up as a kid. If you read that article, is it biased against the church? I mean, are the facts in question? He asks for her, and then he says, like, it's just a test. And then he marries the daughter, the 14-year-old daughter, 2 months later, if we put it on a timeline. He wanted the mom and then went for the daughter. Interesting. That sort of thing is very revealing, right? When they say there's not enough data, if you start to sign and measure, you start to see there is enough data to draw a conclusion. We may not be able to say we know for sure, but it points us in a direction, and we can talk to that. I firmly believe that Helen Mar Kimball was Joseph's wife and that he did have unscrupulous designs. How's that? All right. So, to be epistemological guardians, what do we need to do? And this is true whether you're in the workplace, whether you're in your home, whether it's just you. You need to be aware of what claims are made by yourself. Whenever you say, I know that 25th Street in Ogden is the crediest town in Utah, how do you know that? That was a claim my mom made frequently. She hated 25th Street. Now it's like a place where you can go and party. You can skydive and the thing. And she used to go down there and get food at Iggy's every like week. But there was a long time where she knew that this was just a really bad place. When we make these claims, be aware. Write it down. Jot it down. Have a methodology. How do you test these claims that we make? Challenge knowledge that falls outside that methodology, right? Someone says something like, I know that Joseph Smith ate popcorn on Thursdays. We need to say, okay, pause. I do not have a methodology to test this. Where did you get that? What's the source? Let's talk more and not be afraid to be challenged. Maybe he really did. Maybe it came from trees. Put it to the test and confirm the results. I can't say it enough. Think of a way to test it. Think of a way to prove yourself wrong. That's the goal. You want to be wrong. If this person says he ate popcorn on Thursdays, I'm going to come up with the null hypothesis of Joseph Smith never ate popcorn, right? And then I'm going to search the records to prove myself wrong. Was popcorn invented in the 1800s? Did he ever eat it? Do we have a record of him stringing it on a Christmas tree? If I can prove myself wrong, it gives that person a little more credibility. I just made that up, by the way. I have no idea if he ate popcorn on Thursdays. But they did string popcorn on trees because we have Laura Ingalls Wilder, who's a contemporary, talking about it. Celebrate being wrong. And this is a hard one. We all love to be right. We love to know things. We love to be the person who has the information always. It's universal to humans. It feels bad to find out we were wrong. If you can turn that feeling of, gee, I wish people didn't know what I was really thinking and feeling into a celebration. Life gets a lot easier, for one thing. You can be wrong all the time, and it's great. When we run a test, there's three outcomes that can happen, right? We change the button from blue to orange, and people click it at 10% more. Everyone celebrates that. More money! Everyone's happy! Woo! You can get a negative 10%. People hated orange. They really like the blue button. And I celebrate that too. Woohoo! We know that button color matters. We learned something, right? We can do action. We can change, you know, either shift different colors. We just know that people love that button. We have learned that that is something on the page that matters. If you can celebrate being wrong, you learn things a lot faster. The third thing that can happen is that nothing happens. I hate that. That's the worst. Okay, this button color doesn't even matter. No one's looking at this. We have to start digging into, like, is anyone even seeing this? Is it below on the page? Is there some sort of aspect of this that people have to click this button? So no matter what we do with it, they're going to click the button. We could make it be giant or tiny or off in the upper right-hand corner. Everyone who needs this is going to find that regardless. I hate because you have to drill in so much more. I'd much rather be wrong than have nothing happen. Make sense? Don't worry about titles. I don't care who said it. Mark Twain, Brigham Young, CEO, the VP, the janitor. I got taught an awful lot by drunk homeless men in Sweden. They had some amazing wisdom. And as a missionary, I kept saying, like, why do they have better quotes than general authorities? All right. This is, the basic overview. I want to go back and play a little bit now that we have a sound system. Do we have a sound system? Of the being wrong, because I think that is really key. We talk about humility and that pride is like the great sin within Mormonism, but we have a really hard time accepting when we are just flat wrong. Let's see if we can get it to work. Hey. With sound? Oh, you can't see it. Why can't you see it? Can I drag it over? Hey, there we go. And now I can't see where the play button is. Guide my mouse. Use the force. Can't see it at all. Duplicate.
There you go.
All those years of technology pay off for that moment.
So it's 1995. I'm in college. And a friend and I go on a road trip from Providence, Rhode Island to Portland, Oregon. You know, we're young and unemployed, so we do the whole thing on back roads, through state parks and national forests, basically the longest route we can possibly take. And somewhere in the middle of South Dakota, I turn to my friend and I ask her a question that's been bothering me for 2,000 miles. What's up with the Chinese character I keep seeing by the side of the road? My friend looks at me totally blankly. There's actually a gentleman in the front row who's doing a perfect imitation of her look. And I'm like, you know, all the signs we keep seeing with the Chinese character on them. She just stares at me for a few moments. And then she cracks up because she figures out what I'm talking about. And what I'm talking about is this. Right. The famous Chinese character for picnic area. I have spent the last 5 years of my life thinking about situations exactly like this. Why we sometimes misunderstand the signs around us and how we behave when that happens. And what all of this can tell us about human nature. In other words, as you heard Chris say, I've spent the last 5 years thinking about being wrong. This might strike you as a strange career move, but it actually is one great advantage. No job competition. In fact, most of us do everything we can to avoid thinking about being wrong, or at least to avoid thinking about the possibility that we ourselves are wrong. You know, we get it in the abstract. We all know everybody in this room makes mistakes. The human species in general is fallible. Okay, fine. But when it comes down to me right now, to all the beliefs I hold here in the present tense, suddenly all of this abstract appreciation of fallibility goes out the window. And I can't actually think of anything I'm wrong about.
Can anyone think of something that you're wrong about right now? Hard.
And the thing is, you know, the present tense is where we live. We go to meetings in the present tense. We go on family vacations in the present tense. We go to the polls and vote in the present tense. So effectively, we all wind up kind of traveling through life sort of trapped in this little bubble of feeling very right about everything. I think this is a problem. I think it's a problem for each of us as individuals in our personal and professional lives. And I think it's a problem for all of us collectively as a culture. So what I want to do today is, first of all, talk about why we get stuck inside this feeling of...
The rest of it is basically the rest of my talk. This idea that we are in this constant bubble of feeling like we are right and that we can't think of anything we're wrong about, this is why people stay in religions. This is why people make bad decisions in companies. This is why we do the things that we do where we drive until the tank runs out of gas because we believe we had an extra 50 miles because we saw it on Seinfeld and Kramer said that you can keep going way past the E. Whatever it is, this is how we get ourselves in trouble. And if we can take some time to think about how we know what we know, quantify it, measure it, and then put effort into this new information that comes in, we will have more successful lives. And we will open up for Q&A.
Thank you very much. I enjoyed your talk. In the last two decades, an enormous amount of research has indicated multiple types of animals know much more than we ever thought they knew before. We know now that the great apes are able to understand highly sophisticated symbols and sign language. Dogs understand much of human speech. Birds conceptualize and can communicate their concepts to other members of the flock and so on. Why is it, though, that what they know is true? Somehow in these animal communities, the kind of burden of false knowledge or false is it something in our culture, our development, our aging process? I know this is a question out of left field.
Yeah.
But why is it that this seems to be, this terrible defect, a human trait?
So I actually addressed that in the opening chapter of the book. So I can plug my book again. Thank you. My supposition, what I believe, right, we have this ability to tell that the saber-toothed tiger is growling at us and that that's bad. And that societies grew from everyone who could outrun the saber-toothed tiger together. And I'm doing a little Flintstones there because I know they weren't contemporary with man, but whatever. This idea that the survivors were those who could bond together with society, and that produced this defect. This is my supposition. I'm not claiming knowledge, just to be clear. What I believe happened is people who could show that you could climb the tree together, that you were a bond and you became a tribe, and that tribe could get out from the danger. And this led to other things that we saw as common, right? If you've ever had the moment where you're standing in line and you're like, I really love Fresca, some rare kind of soda pop, and the person next to you is like, I love Fresca too, and you instantly feel this like kind of commonality bond, and you start trying to see what else you have in common. That's a very natural, basic thing. And I think we possess that in a way that the other species do not, apes to some degree do. Depending on your species and so forth. But I think that that was both what made us come out on top, even though that we are squishy pink things with no claws, scales, or really any defense mechanism beyond brains, and the other animals, is that we were able to bond together as society. But now we bond over things that aren't true. We bond over things that aren't real. If you talk about that the Yankees are going to win the World Series, you can find any number of friends online or in your workplace, even though there's just no evidence they're going to win at all. I don't know about if the Yankees actually are going to win. The Cubs. A Cubs is the ultimate one, right? Richard Dutcher is on my Facebook page. I've taken a screen class from him, and we interact every once in a while, and he will always cheer for the Cubs no matter how much evidence there exists that they will never get to the World Series. And then they did. And he had so many friends that were just sure that he'd been right all along. It was a bonding thing. It wasn't an actual knowledge. Again, that's my supposition based on the research I did for the book, which go to someone who is actually in the field.
What's the title of the book you're talking about?
And it's now available on Amazon as of last week.
One of the things that becomes difficult is when the test.
Technical difficulties, please stand by.
When the test of knowledge is such that it's unethical to test because the control group would be harmed, the negative group would be harmed. How do you deal with that and knowledge? Because that is prevalent in anything that involves a person and anything that might harm or help them.
Yeah, absolutely. This is something that's pretty serious. All the way to if you try to do experimentation on humans in junior high, you have to actually get forms. There's a specific form to enter the science fair with human research that you have to fill out to get permission from everyone that you test on. And it's challenging. I'll give two examples that come out of my life. in embarrassing ways because we like to be wrong, right? Once upon a time, I had become on the ex-Mormon side of the equation, but I still defend the church whenever information is wrong. I think it's important to have real information regardless of whichever side of the fence you fall on. That's just valuable. And the subject came up about the human testing at BYU on homosexuals. For those of you that don't know what they would do, this is 1976 to 1978. There is a paper, and I've posted it online. Anyone can go and read the results. They would scoop up people that they found were gay, primarily by driving around parking lots and gay bars and taking down license plates, and then they would call the student in and threaten their academic future if they did not participate in the study. That is not a random sample. They would then give them, show them porn, and then either use electrodes or make them vomit to try to cure the gay. It's known as reparative therapy or reparation therapy, and it was denounced by the church in 2012, which is a good thing. When the person who started the therapy renounced his paper, the church followed suit, more or less. More or less. And I was defending this online. Someone said, you know, this is ugly, it's awful, it should never have happened, I'm ashamed of the church. And I was saying, no, it was 1976 to 1978. Whenever you're testing on humans, it's messy. Here are all the other universities that were doing it at the same time. And one of my acquaintances, someone I knew back in college, contacted me and said, I went through that. And not wanting to be wrong and having all my confirmation biases, I corrected him and said, no, that happened in 1976 to 78. You were at BYU in 94. And he replied very lovingly, I think I remember the vomit. It turns out they continued to study on humans for almost two decades after they learned that it doesn't work. And in quiet and private ways. And he did a tour for me and took me to the room that had the padding and showed me how the other students couldn't hear him scream. I don't know how he got the key to get me in. I didn't ask. I just was gawking and amazed through the entirety of the experience. And since then, we found that it happened in 86. I posted online. I've had people say, I was in part of that study in 81, and that was the last year they did it. And then immediately following, someone posts, I was in it in 82, and that's the last year they did it. It's messy. It's hard. I think the important thing is follow the correct procedures. Get your documentation squared away. Make sure that people are willing participants. Publish the data and stop doing it if it's hurting people. If you can't, right? And we can't bring people in and run tests on them in the company that I work for. We try to find good surrogates, and I know that's a terrible answer because how do you do that is the real thing you're asking. And it's really difficult to sit down and say, is there a way we can back into this information? Is there a way that someone's already done it? So like slavery, right? What I was talking about with the economics program, they didn't go and put 70 people into slavery and 70 into indentured servitude and then run the study for 70 years to see at what point they became valuable. You go back and try to find something in history that matches what you're studying and run the analysis on that as though it were a test. And that's about as close as I've been able to find. There's a couple of other techniques, but that's probably the best I can give in the time that we're here.
Just
follow up.
Quick follow up on it. There's a lot of studies have been done where you use anecdotal evidence, people's memories, people's experience as they perceived it. And my only follow up is, how do you correct for the bias in those things? Because they are wildly, my memory is wildly different than my wife's memory about the exact same thing that happened.
Yeah, I stop reading those studies. No, I mean, we all know that memory is really bad. Eyewitness testimony is one of the worst kinds, and we can talk about certain testimonies all day long here that were given and written down, and whether they have validity or not. I just want to take the fourth witness that didn't make it because she was female. That would be David Whitmer's wife, who had the angel Moroni show up in brown clothing, open a knapsack, and show her the plates. Somehow that didn't make it into the lore. I don't know. How do you trust her husband's testimony and discard hers? Someone makes that decision, and we all follow it afterwards. Testimony is hard. Eyewitness and memory and trying to do that sort of thing, I always try to read those with a grain of salt. And if we are working with document, so that's a lot of why we have how we know, and recording, we did a test on that, right? I have honestly, that's number two, because I said I'd do two examples where I failed. I have misremembered tests where I was like, yeah, we were up 46%. This was a really great test. You should run with it. And we go back, you know, 2 or 3 years in the data, and that test was a failure. I was combined two tests together. Document it, record it, make sure you can go back and not rely on your own memory, because it is. It's bad. And whenever you read a study that's all memories, grain of salt. We had another one over here. I think we killed the battery on two people. That's amazing.
First of all, my wife and I like to thank you for all you've added to our journey.
You're welcome.
All of your Reddit posts have been, you're so articulate, and you put things down in a way that's really easy to read, and we really appreciate it. And I'd just like to take a second and just bring into the conversation this matters to us. This is really important to us because, you know, Alma 32 and hope, believe leads to knowledge, and I know it's sometimes semantics, and that's what my question is ultimately going to be about, but I want to read two sentences from an email my father just sent, my 84-year-old former stake president father. My wife and I have been on a journey outside leaving the church for about 3 years now, and we've been really successful in building boundaries and trying to keep my father, you know, we love you, Dad, but my dad has started to send emails to my gay son that are really – really hard for us, and that's where the boundaries come into place. And finally, he just sent this email to us this week when I pushed back and said, please don't send these things to my son anymore.
Just a side note, if they continue to send emails after you want, you can get them under the Canned Spam Act in Utah. It's actually a law. And they get fined $7,000 for being a business sending emails after you ask to stop, even if it's just your father.
And
go on.
And my son's blocked him, but it's, you know, right. It's all about relationships. And so my dad sends this and says, Paul, why would you leave the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints when I know beyond a shadow of a doubt that it's true? Why would you break your word and covenant in the Lord's temple when you are still together forever? How could you give your children and your wife up so easily when I know it's true? So when you say I know, you in the sense of factual truth, that is exclusive. You don't leave any room there for difference of views on theological issues. And so it's all inclusively when my dad says I know, he's also saying I know all the statements about how evil apostates are is also true. And so that views our relationship on how I know he views me. It also says I know all the things the church teaches about LGBT issues, not necessarily today, but back in Spencer W. Kimball, Bruce R. McConkie days, is also I know is true. And so that reflects what I know he's thinking about us and my son. And so all the words of saying, but I love you, we love you, but I know this is true, it causes huge cognitive dissonance and it leaves huge gaps in relationships. So how can you, any ideas on how you can get people that believe I know in that way to understand there's differences in that? It means I can say I know I love my wife, but it's not factual. Sorry.
In 5 minutes. Okay. So you bring up some really good points. I'm going to want to touch on Alma really quickly. Well, we'll start with how I ended up how I am. You have to thank my father. He wanted me to become an apologist working for the Maxwell Institute. So there were a lot of long sessions of learning Cortez's journal and memorizing Mayan Ball and when the Olmecs did whatever that ended up with me being who I am. Second, Alma. So on my mission, I loved Alma because I was still very science-based even back then. I'm like, look, it's a scientific method. And then I came home and reviewed the scientific method again and realized it's just confirmation bias. It is exactly 2, 4, 8, 12, 16, 32, 64. It's just if you plant the seed and it feels good, you're in the right path. And if it continues to feel good, you're in the right path. It is exactly the opposite of science. It is what led people to believe in the vital essence and that you could if you've ever heard of the mythology of golems, or the stone men, not the thing from Lord of the Rings, but the stone men who walk around, all of that comes from this idea that you could take the essence of life out of a person and put it into a rock. because rocks were fundamentally different. All of that comes from confirmation bias sorts of approaching. And it was all reverted with the idea of we try to disprove. So what Alma should be saying is something more close to what Moroni says, right? If these things are not true, or pray if these things are not true, you should be testing if the seed feels good. You need to try to beat that seed down and crush it all the ways you can. And if it continues to come up, then it's a good seed. You shouldn't just, oh, well, it's kind of coming up like a tree. It's good. For those of you who don't know Alma 32, I'm so sorry, because it's a really strong thing for those of us who know. Now, to your question, how do you deal with people who say they know? So I had a fascinating experience in the mountains this last week where I got left with a Reformed Mormon, not as in he had left Mormonism, but as in he'd come back after alcoholism and drug abuse and really knew it was true. And if you've ever had the chance to talk to those people, not if anyone's in here, I don't mean to offend, but they really know. They have this certainty that you don't find anywhere else. And as we were walking for 2 hours, he continued to say, you know, I know that this is true. And I said, it's slightly offensive when you say that. You can't say I know without implying everyone else is wrong. And I'd rather that you didn't build up your faith by putting mine down. And he had just given me this lecture about you shouldn't try to tear down other people's faiths for a good 15 minutes. And I was like, but you, whenever you say I know it, you are tearing other people down. Can you please not do that? And okay, what we can do. So there is this wonderful book called The Wizard of Ads, and it's part of this presentation when I do it for companies, but I kind of split it down so we'd have the Q&A session, and I'm sorry I didn't include it. But the guy is absolutely fabulous when it comes to marketing and advertisement, and what you're really talking about is marketing. You're going to interact with someone and sell them on a concept that they don't actually know. And you need to, first of all, get that in your mind. That's the goal. The goal is not to convince them. It's not to make them leave Mormonism. It's not to change their whole outlook. What you're trying to do is just get them to admit, I don't know 100%. Okay? The second step is that we have this piece of our brain called Broca. And Broca looks for anything that is new and novel, anything that is different from the day-to-day. That's its job. And it will only let in information that is new and novel. If you've ever seen the Old Spice commercials, right? I'm on a horse. Those tickets for those things you love. The reason that commercial worked is it got Broca. Broca is like, and he does this comparison in the book, like the little door guy in The Wizard of Oz. Nobody gets in to see the wizard, not nobody, not know how, right? He will only let in, you're Dorothy, the witch is Dorothy. There's this new novel concept. He lets that information in. So you have to find a way to approach this in a new and novel way, right? Once you do that, you need something sticky, something that catches. Just by Broca, we have the cochlea, which is, according to the Wizard of Ads, and there's, he cites science to back it up now on his blog, the part of our brain that gets those stupid tunes that you can't get out of your mind from all the advertisements. It's why those sorts of tunes work for advertising, that it plays over and over and over in your mind. If you can get through the door and then get an idea that gets stuck and gets played over and over, you can change people's paradigms. That's what marketing seeks to do. So what you need, and in this case, maybe it's saying, you know, on Mormon.org, there is a thing that says people can be gay and it's just fine. Or maybe it's a talk by Elder Uchtdorf where he says people who leave the church aren't so bad, right? Or maybe it's some sort of concept that just didn't sink in with your father before. And once you get that, you want to tie it to something he's going to see every day. You want to tie it to something that's going to stick over and over. So with this poor guy who was hiking with Mithrin and had no idea who he was next to, I said, I don't know that God is good. I need you to prove to me that God is good before I would ever do anything with the religion, whether you know it or not. He could be deceiving you. How do you know? We went to epistemological guardianship. And he said, well, I guess I don't know. I guess I'm not sure if it's – I mean, I think I know. I feel it, but I don't know. How do I know it? And I tied it together with, you know, testimony meeting. And every time someone says, I know, I want you to think about how those people know. I want you to listen for how those people know. And I want you to come back to me and explain how each of those people claim their knowledge. And this means this poor guy, every time he goes to fast and testimony meeting, is going to be served a heaping helping of cognitive dissonance because they never state how they know. There's never an epistemological evaluation of like, I know – sometimes they will say, I know it because I prayed really hard or because God let me know. But there's something not – once you start thinking about what if God is not leading me correct – That doesn't satisfy anymore. Like, I need to know that he's a good person. Anyway, that is what I would recommend, is you got to have something that gets past Broca, something that catches and sticks, and that they will talk themselves out of the knowledge eventually. And then you can start to have a decent conversation. And that's really all you're trying to get to.
Thanks, everyone, for your participation.